This is Brock and Saul.
Brock Huard is my hero.
Jay Buhner just punched me in the kidney.
Power through the Alaska Airlines studio.
On Seattle Sports.
We're going to do you on the interview.
That really worked that way, Sherm. This is a show that has my name on it.
It kind of does, though.
Brought to you by Simply Seattle.
Now here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
Hello!
Hello and happy birthday, Mr. Huard.
Oh, thank you, Michael. I appreciate that. Right out the gates.
Right out the gates. Happy birthday, buddy. Happy tax day birthday to you.
Yeah, on income tax day. Isn't that special?
Yep. Every year.
That's who I am.
What do you got going on there? You're like getting yourself settled.
Yeah, I'm just kind of getting all settled.
All right.
I was running around all last week, so kind of getting settled.
Okay.
There we go. Now I'm here.
We'll get to some big news in your life here in a few minutes, but we got to start with what we all saw and just the Mariners struggling in so many different ways, a bunch of which are all kind of worth discussing. But unfortunately, the story is Julio. He's hitting 186, no home runs yet in the season. One extra base hit, a 441 OPS. His OPS plus is 34. Remember, 100 is average. He's got a negative 0.3 war, which is funny because he's actually won them two games.
Yeah.
But, you know, a negative war according to the numbers overall. And then to top it all off, you get this, you know, kind of brain fart moment of getting picked off. It has not been the start of the season that anybody could have expected for Julio.
No. When the season started, and if you would have said to me on my, you know, when we come to your birthday on income tax day, this is where Julio is going to be sitting, you wouldn't have believed that for a second. Not based on what we saw this spring, not the bounce in his step, not year number three, you know, not, you know, after a slow start last year, carrying too much of the load, not with a little protection that was supposed to be there in the lineup. I mean, not throw all those knots out there. And by the way, talk to the media yesterday. Come on now. I mean, own that. Own that responsibility. Like, you get picked off, which is embarrassing to end a game. You need to, in a day where, you know, the skip gives you time to hopefully relax and reset and refresh, as Scott gave him a day yesterday, probably time to talk to the media, passed on that opportunity. So just a very, very frustrating start for a superstar, no question.
Yeah, I would say a kind of end up yesterday with four questions. And the first, obviously, is, you know, why did he need the day off? Mental, physical. Scott was pretty clear. It is a mental thing, not physical.
Well, you know, you can look at it, you know, as we go. You want your guys that are going best getting the most at-bats. So, you know, and we'll switch it up a little bit tomorrow. They'll have a right-hander on the mound. Last 3 days we've been facing left-handed pitching, so I thought it was really important to get Ty and Haney up there. But, you know, the guys at the top, JP, it's been a struggle for him to get much traction going. And
that was the night before, and then the next morning when Julio did get the day off.
A little change of the lineup today. Julio, just an off day, just let him unplug a little bit. I think it's really important, not just from a physical side, but from a mental side. Just like sometimes you sit back, you watch a game, it looks a whole lot easier. I think we can all attest to that, than it actually is. So that's the reason behind it. There's nothing physically wrong with him. It's just a chance for him to unplug. And, you know, he's a big part of our team. He's huge. You know, to get him going, sometimes a day off will help him.
So he gets a day off to unplug, Brock.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you get it, right? You've tried to do some things with timing. You've tried to do some tinkering with the swing a little bit. You've tried to do what you can do, and this is probably the last little resort 10% of the way into the season is just unplug. Just reset. Just Control-Alt-Delete, right? Just do a little power cycle that you and I like to do. If something's not working, just turn it on or turn it off, and hopefully when we turn it back on and he gets the start tomorrow, or hopefully when he came into the game late in the game, little surprised to not see him pinch hit late in that game. Right?
Well, that was sort of second question, or I mean, the second one for me is, was he aware that he could still be used? And I'm sure he was, but it's something that I would have liked to have known. It's one of the reasons I wish that he had spoken yesterday, because that's important. Hey, you got your day off to unplug and now you're out there pinch running. Right. It's not an excuse for getting picked off, but, you know, being in the right zone, in the right headspace is important. When did he know that that was going to be a possibility that he could be back into that game? I would be curious to know about that. And then, Brock, the next question is exactly what you just asked. Why is he used as a pinch runner and not a pinch hitter? Bottom of the order is coming up. I think I know the answer to this one, but I still think it's a worthwhile question to ask. I think it's because, look, what's Julio, the one thing that you know he can control and do well, regardless of however he's hitting, is run. He's their best base stealer. Yep. And you got already have two outs, so the biggest thing you need in that moment is to get a runner on second base so that a hit ties the game. I thought about that because I was going, man, it's interesting that he's using him as a pinch runner, not as a pinch hitter. But I think that's what I would have done also when I think about it. You?
Sure. Yeah, I think so. And he's probably, not probably, he is a guy of routine. He is a guy that, you know, spends extra time. He is a guy that likes to get his swings in early. He is a guy that I think needs that routine as well. Mm-hmm. You know, not necessarily a pinch hitter, but should be an unbelievable pinch runner until you get picked off.
Right.
To end the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a good look.
Well, I mean, no, obviously. Thankfully, it wasn't a case where he was caught napping, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. That is, to me, a true mental mistake, right? You get caught napping in a moment where, you know, you're not really even supposed to be doing anything. That's a mental mistake, and you obviously, you know, you can't have that. I'm not excusing this because it's terrible. I mean, it is just a brutal way to lose a game, but at least he's trying to steal second. He's caught leaning because he's hoping to steal second, and he got beat physically by a pitcher who made a good move. It doesn't make it okay. It doesn't make it any more. I mean, but at least it wasn't just a flat-out mental error.
No, and I think it probably goes into the bucket of many of these things over the first 16 games of running through a stop sign. I'm running through the stop sign because I'm hyper-competitive. I'm airmailing the cutoff man because I think I get him all the way at home, and I airmail that because I'm hyper-competitive. I'm pressing probably a little too much because I know I can hit home run after home run after home run, and this team desperately needs me to start doing that. So I think this fits into that bucket that we have seen through the first 16 games. My good old-fashioned trying too hard, trying to do too much, rather than just let the game come to you. And by the way, all those things have happened. We haven't really talked about them because he didn't really need to talk about them. Yeah, he's a hyper-competitive dude. But you start to add them up, like, come on now. Hyper-competitive is great, but it's got to be focused in this lane here.
Yeah.
Talk about this all the time in a front seven. That's great. I know you want to go make that tackle, but you are out of assignment, and you actually are hurting the rest of the group up front schematically when you're jumping into, well, I'm just trying to make a play. I'm just trying to make a play.
Yeah.
We don't need you to make a play. We need you to just simply go out there and execute.
Yeah.
Go out and do your job and execute.
And then obviously the last question is just, why didn't he talk afterwards? And I'm with you, man. That does bug me. Take the accountability and move on. Hopefully this is a learning experience for him, but I do believe that learning to handle frustrating moments in public in this game in particular, it comes right along with learning to deal with the public appreciation and adulation. It's important. Mm-hmm. When you don't deal with it, your teammates have to. And as a young leader, as the best player on this team, even when you're struggling, I want to see Julio take a level of accountability because somebody's got to answer those questions. And it really, you know, should be him.
Yeah, and I'm going to guess maybe today, right? Maybe he was just too fired up and just not in a good enough place. And maybe today he addresses it before the game and just, you know, like, hey, this is where I was at. Let me be transparent. Mm-hmm. Just not in a place, you know, and this has been a brutal start for me. And I know that I've got to be a better leader. So I'm going to assume whether today or tomorrow at some point we are going to hear from him. And I'm also going to assume, Salk, that he's not going to have many more of these stretches of 15 or 16 games without a home run.
I would agree with that.
I'm gonna bet on that, and I'm gonna bet once he sees that ball go over the fence, once he sees that ball hit the fence, once he sees that ball in the gap and he gets going, it is gonna hopefully get him going and hopefully get this rest of this dormant offense that right now is just struggling to put anything together.
Yeah, it's just been so frustrating because I started off at 6 o'clock. I just want to see what this offense is supposed to look like.
Yes.
I just want to see if it works. And with this many guys hitting so far below an expected, you know, where they could possibly hit, you don't even get a chance to see what the plan is. And I think that's been really frustrating, probably more than anything. And yet, as you sit here today, most surprising thing of the season, the Mariners are 2 games out of first place in the AOS. Just bizarre. Yeah. Bizarre how baseball works. So they'll get back to it tonight. We'll come right back with everything you need to know. It's Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710.
Need to know.
15 minutes past every hour with Brock and Salk.
Here's what you need to know. up first.
So funny, because it really did start off pretty promisingly on Friday night. The bats started to come to life early a little bit. Bryce Miller threw a whale of a game, pitched deep into that one, and you're going, all right, I think maybe this is going to be the weekend where the Mariners start to turn it around and we get to see how this team was kind of designed to be. And instead, the offense abandoned them Saturday, didn't show up Sunday either. They had their chances. Bases loaded in the eighth. Double play, unfortunately, from Ty France. Then in the ninth, it was Julio's turn to make a huge mistake.
And the pitch on the way. No, a toss over to first base. And safe at first is Julio Rodriguez. Holy smokes, that was close. Close. Julio was leaning towards second. He's able to dive back to the far corner of the bag. The throw looked like had him beat, but the late tag.
Oh, my goodness. Where is he going? Come on.
No. The call on the field is overturned. The runner is out.
Oh, man. What a disappointing, heartbreaking loss for the Mariners this afternoon. The call is overturned. Instead of being safe, Julio Rodriguez out, picked off by Alzolay, and that's how this game ends.
Where was he going, Dave Sims? He was trying to get into scoring position to help his team to try to get to those extra innings, Salk, where, man, if they can only get to extra innings and get those zombie runners,
right?
This offense does get going. They do get themselves started. Just 1 of 15 over those two games with runners in scoring position.
Yeah.
You said it, they have multiple opportunities. The Cubbies ran into some home runs. One cat ran into them. One of them every single game of this series, Marsh, but you just did not and just did not get that hit that you really need. It felt like, I honestly felt like they're going to win yesterday, going to win the series. I think they split the opening series. They've lost now every series since, find themselves at 6-10 with the only silver lining being the Rangers also scuffling. So just a couple games.
I'll give you one more. Luis looked a whole lot better yesterday, which was good. Allowed 3 runs. Only 2 of them were earned. Yes, he gave up the home run, but the other was on an error that he made himself. A lot more swings and misses, which is sort of what's been missing from his game. So hopefully he starts to turn a corner. You see George Kirby tonight against the Reds. Then on the other side of it, Dominic Canzone headed to the injured list after his collision with the wall. Apparently has a sprained AC joint in his shoulder. He is the team leader in home runs with 3. But they're going to replace him with some speed. Young Jonathan Classe is going to take his spot, and he is a runner. That's the thing he's great at. I don't know if he's a great defensive player yet, and I don't know whether he can get on base. But if he does, that dude can seriously scoot.
Here's the second thing you need to know.
How many times have we mentioned the name Laken Tomlinson over the last couple of weeks? He is finally going to sign a deal with the Seahawks. A veteran guard, spent a 9-year career in Detroit, San Francisco, and in New York with the Jets. He's a left guard, and he plays every day. That's about it.
Every time I hear you say guard, I mean, it's just Roger. Roger Dodger, our buddy down in Tacoma. Every time you say, can I just get a guard? Can we still find a way to get a guard? He was the winner out of the 3 of them. There were 3 veterans that they had brought in, Whitehair, Von Roten, and Tomlinson. One of those 3 was going to be signed before the draft came, and maybe a little leverage or a little play between them and their agents over the last few weeks. And ultimately, they do settle on Tomlinson. Still a pretty good run blocker, Saul. Can still move people. I think he was 34th out of qualifying guards when it came to pass protection. Those numbers don't sound great, but they were better than Bradford and Phil Haynes, who's still on the market, and some of the other guys that started for you. So, yep, you bring in just another veteran piece. We've got a few of those on the interior of this offensive line. Should not preclude them from making a move, 10 days from now in the draft as well.
Here's the third thing you need to know.
Well, congratulations to Scottie Scheffler. He is on one heck of a run right now. He's now the 2-time Masters champion. Birdied 6 of his last 11 holes yesterday to beat Ludvig Åberg by 5 strokes. It was crazy the way they were all tied early. Åberg and Homa, Morikawa, and then Scottie's just a finisher, man. Jeez. You give that guy a lead late on Sunday, and he is just 100%, does not flinch. He is robotic, isn't he?
He is. At this point, and I know the footwork is so goofy and at times hard to watch and certainly not sustainable over the long term. You talk about what Mitch Haniger does with his ankle. How in the world does he do that? Like buckling his knees together, the amount of force that drives through his legs. You know what strikes me, though, is he is just mentally tough. Mm-hmm. Like just Texas mentally tough. I don't really care what the circumstances are, and I'm going to grind you. And if we got to grind it out and Par's going to do this thing, I can grind it out and Par. Like, there's just no mental flinch between he and his caddy. And did you see the note? He has done so well, has Mr. Scheffler, this year, that his caddy, who makes, I think, 10% of their winning, something like that. Yeah, 10%. Because he's won over $12 million. His caddy's won over $1.2 million, which would be like 54th on the tour for person. If he were a player on the tour, he'd be like 54th.
That's crazy.
In money made.
Wow.
And he's doing it as a caddy because Scotty, as you said, is
just on wait till you find
fire.
Out that his caddy's on his way to live to really take advantage and make some money. Let's see. WNBA draft will be tonight at 4:30. Caitlin Clark expected to go number one overall to the Indiana Fever. Something she let Michael Che know about. Out on Saturday Night Live.
Pretty good.
All right, that's everything you need to know. Quarter past every hour here in the Brock and Salk Show. Although there is one other thing you should probably know. Breaking news on, I don't know when the date was. Was it Thursday, Friday? When did the news really get out there, Brock?
Thursday, Friday. I think the news got out. Okay. Thursday, the commitment came, which was a pretty cool 48 hours. Titus got to go along on this trip with Mom and I and Macy out to Stillwater, Oklahoma. So get your tickets ready, Salt. Make your way. There's a flight from Dallas, like two a day from Dallas right into Stillwater.
Perfect.
Or you can just take that.
I'd have to be in
like
Dallas. Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, you get to Seattle to Dallas. And then you get up to Stillwater. So, yep, Macy committed to go be an Oklahoma State Cowboy. Cowgirl, in her case, the lady cowgirl. So pretty cool. Going to play basketball there. Great group of people. Great young, dynamic coach. And she can get to run and cut and just play her style of game, which will be an absolute blast.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing for those who have followed this at all. Macy and Haley, Brock's two kids, both playing at University of Montana. Macy opted to transfer this year, and she's going to go to a Power 5 school at Oklahoma State. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we'll get to see her in the tournament next year. How awesome would that be?
Yeah, there's one thing that did come into my mind that I never thought with this whole transfer portal and all these other players, and I have certainly had my struggles at times with it, Salk, and those that transfer 2, 3, 4 different times. But the one thing that struck me being this close to it is watching my daughter at 16 and 17 mm-hmm. navigate recruiting versus at 18.
Yeah.
I mean, she was really, really young. She probably, if her parents had any sense, would have probably held her back. And so she could have had a little bit more maturity the first time around. But just watching her process and handle what she wants after spending a year, an amazing year with her sister, and just her conversations and her poise and her questions. And, you know, this is what I'm looking for. This is what I want now. And that understanding, because of previous experience elsewhere, played just an amazing role in this decision this time around. And as a dad, it was pretty fun to watch her navigate.
Well, congratulations to you. Congratulations to her as well. The whole Hewitt family, of course. All right. Coming up next, I am fascinated to see what the Seahawks look like here after this draft is done. But when you look at it on paper, there is, not just one, but three things, Brock, that I'm a little concerned about. And I'm hoping maybe you can alleviate some of my fear this morning. It's Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710, seattlesports.com.
You're listening to Brock and Salk.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
On Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app.
I'm trying to look, Brock, not just a couple of weeks into the future, but over the next couple of years, okay? Which is obviously incredibly difficult to do, right? No one here has the crystal ball, so you're just trying to make guesses on what direction things go. And as I look at the Seahawks, on paper, they have kind of a funky roster, right? Sort of built in a strange way. They've got some questions still up front. They've got a good but not quite elite quarterback. And they've got rookie coaches at like the three biggest, most important spots where we don't really know what those guys are going to look like in the NFL. And oh, by the way, they don't have a tremendous amount of draft capital this year after that number 16 pick. So as I look for their next 3 years, I am a little curious what the Seahawks will look like over the course of that time. Because as you look at the division, who's the most talented team in the league right now today?
Yeah, I think that's still San Francisco.
Still San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the coach in this league that seems to get the most out of whomever he happens to have at the moment? That's still Sean McVay.
Mm-hmm.
And who's the team with maybe the most draft capital and a coach who, despite seeming like kind of a loser, was able to get his team to play incredibly hard last year, even though they were not nearly as talented as some of the others around them? Well, that's Arizona, where I saw your buddy DJ tweeting over the weekend that if they play this draft right, they could set themselves up for a really nice five-year run based off of that. So come back then to the Mariners, or to the Seahawks, rather. What is the three-year outlook as of today for where the Seahawks are at?
Yeah, you know, I'll probably come back and I'll continue to beat the drum, Salk, that I've beaten here for the last couple months in this offseason. And that is this new regime, these new set of eyes, the new innovation that comes with these offensive and defensive systems and a very smart, you continue to hear that word every time a Seahawk player opens his mouth, you know, how smart these coaches are, that they are going to give a still young core, a young core. You talk about this roster kind of being a little bit funky. You have a young core. You have two young difference-making offensive tackles. You have two young difference-making running backs. You have a young difference maker in Devin Weatherspoon, who, remember, early in the year, Troy Aikman compared to Deion Sanders is like one of these just rare, rare players that is a rookie, is out here looking like the best player on the team. And then you surrounded some of that young core with a lot of 1 year and 2 year, you know, very short term deals with some veteran players at linebacker, at backup tackle, at guard, at tight end. Like, okay, you know, we're going to try to balance out some of that young core youth with some guys on short-term deals, Salk, so that if this young core hits, right, if Woolen bounces back to being the rookie of the year, defensive rookie of the year candidate he was his first year, and Spoon, you know, takes another step, you're talking about a couple elite corners. So, yeah, I mean, it's not ideal. It doesn't feel
explain
like
to me the end of that. Why, if that happens, why do you want the guys on short-term deals around them?
So you can take care of your own, like they did in 11 and 12 and 13 and 14, when those guys proved and they showed you that they are difference makers, that it's always better to do it with your own.
That makes sense.
You know, and I will not back away from that sentiment, kind of a foundational belief I always have, you know, and I think our baseball team is somewhat reflective of that as well. Like, look at those homegrown pitchers that you developed, that came up. You know them so well. Those are your guys. And it should mean a little more, and it matters a little bit more when you're homegrown within that organization, all the goodwill that comes from that versus, you know, the offensive pieces they've tried to bring in from afar, and those teams they've left seem to have known a little bit more about them than you do as you bring them in. So I think that's why they, you know, have structured it this way, really hoping K9 or really hoping Charbonnet or really hoping Woolen or really hoping Charles Cross or really hoping these guys go from good to great. Because I think they're good players, and it's why they've been, you know, a 9-win team and right there made the playoffs 1 year in the final game and missed it in the final game the next year. I think they're good players. Can they be great? Well, that's upon them in a whole new set of eyes and schemes and coaches, Salk, that should hopefully, you know, in this case, unlock them to take that next step.
It does feel like they are betting quite a bit on the new coaching staff unlocking some of the talent that they already have.
That's right.
Right?
Oh, did I mention Boye?
That feels like a big bet.
Yeah, and I didn't mention Boye Mafe, and I didn't mention Derek Hall, and I didn't mention, you know, some of these young guys that you have taken there in the first and second round, Jackson Smith and Jigba. Right? I mean, is Jackson Smith and Jigba good? Is he average? Can he be great? I mean, goodness gracious, after the draft last year and how many times over OTAs and you know, before he broke his wrist in training camp, were we sitting there going, dude doesn't drop a ball. Dude is a vacuum. Dude is amazing. Dude is beating everybody on the field. And then, you know, it slowed with the injury and just over the course of the season, just, you know, never felt like the whole system was always on tilt and always going. So I don't know. I think that is where certainly I think they would push back and say, Salk, you know, you talk about this roster. Let me tell you where this roster is. Jackson and Charbonnet and K9 and Spoon and Woolen and Mafe. These are.
But
these
I'm going to laugh because every person you just mentioned, none of them play at the line of scrimmage.
Well, okay. Charles Cross, Abe Lucas, Boye Mafe. I mean, those are line of scrimmage people. You know, Jaron's there. Leonard's there. Those are two good to great pros. Right, those two guys are good enough in the middle of even your Super Bowl run that you were on with those guys in the middle of your line. Those are difference makers. So, yeah, it's not at the line of scrimmage, but there are a lot of young pieces, Salk, that if they take the step, that's I think what they're banking on is these guys got to take the next step, and it's both on them as players and certainly on the coaches to put them in position to do so.
How concerning is the other side of that with some of the other some of the other teams in your division and where they're at? Because the I guess what it was ultimately this conversation was kind of leading me to is, and I think I know your answer based on the way you've sort of talked through it so far, does where you're at compared to the teams around you start to necessitate some big swings, or is this still about subtle maneuvering? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like kind of when you look at
because
their
roster. Because this year has been about, in this offseason, has been about subtle maneuvering.
Roster-wise.
It has been about a couple one-year linebackers, been about a two-year safety, right? Been about a bunch of linemen on 1 and 2 year deal, kind of subtle maneuvers, right? To kind of put some patch up that little hole there and patch up with some spackle that little hole there and make sure we're covered here and make sure we've got enough depth there. So yeah, I would call this offseason of free agency, Sam Howell move, I would call it subtle maneuvering rather than taking any massive big swing.
Right. Is that the right call right now?
Well, I think when you start this conversation with your quarterback, yeah, I think that's the right call, right? I think if you have a Matthew Stafford that you're going to go all in on, you go for it. I think if you are going to run with Brock Purdy, boy, you better surround him, you know, with a whole bunch of talent, a bunch of places, and then go for it, right? And we've seen that with other teams in this league. Like when the pieces are in place and it's go time, let's step on the gas. Mm-hmm. Let's step on the accelerator. Let's, you know, it's a 2-0 count. Got the count in our favor. Let's make sure we're hyper-aggressive and not let it go.
There is that element to it, yes. But the flip side of that is if you are not close enough to being in that category, do you need to start making some bigger swings, taking some different risks in order to try to get there? Because subtle maneuvering is only going to change your roster in subtle ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you've got to give this group, all of these first-timers, your first-time head coach, your first-time coordinator, your first-time defense coordinator. I think, Salk, you also got to let them get their feet on the ground too, right? I think you got to let them figure out a little bit of how they're going to be a head coach. I think Mike McDonald knows himself and knows how he's going to go into it and probably going to feel a lot of John Harbaugh kind of vibes with that. And Harbaugh kind of background, but he's got to be who he is when, you know, the bright lights do go on and he's got to manage a game and make all those decisions. I think Ryan Grubb has a tremendous amount of conviction about how he wants to run it and how he's going to call it and how he's going to create matchups. And, you know, the biggest thing that you hear all the time, and it's true, is that in college you can run your scheme. In the NFL, you better create matchups. And the beauty of his background is his scheme in college does create matchups. That's what he is all about. But I think you got to let those guys get settled. I think you got to let them get comfortable in their own skin before you start swinging for the fences on a whatever the count is there coming their way.
Yeah,
Does that make sense?
It is the great unknown about this season, and it's why as much as I'm interested to see what the roster looks like after the draft. I'm most interested to see what the team looks like as they start getting into training camp and preseason games, because the biggest unknown is the coaching staff. We just don't know, right? I have no idea whether they're going to take some of these players and make them better, or if guys are going to, you know, struggle and maybe aren't as good a fit for this particular coaching staff.
Yep.
I don't know what's going to happen with, you mentioned Boye Mafe. He's a great example. A guy who's grown a little bit in his time here in Seattle, but certainly not as much as you would want him to. Not enough to be a true difference maker. I like the guy a lot, and I think there's a lot of promising talent there.
Yep.
Can this coaching staff turn him into a difference maker? Can they do that with Charles Cross, who we've seen some ups, we've seen some downs, kind of gone with the rest of that offensive line? Can they make him a difference maker?
Right.
Can they make him a Pro Bowl left tackle? Because what I'm seeing now is a lot of guys who sort of got to be good, but not quite great.
Yeah. And I think those guys, every one of you mentioned right there, Salk, you know, that this is the thing about the NFL. And I think for these coaches too, it'd be different. It would be different if I'm just dealing with a bunch of guys that just have no pop.
Right.
Right. They're just Abraham Toros, right? You just get going here and you're like, yep, you're just a Jack. I mean, you're just another guy. Like I don't see any stretch in your big league career here where for a couple weeks you carry us, where for a couple weeks you're like, okay, yep, that's it. You know, unfortunately, the Colton Wong, you know, that you got, he'd done that in earlier parts of his career. But for you, unfortunately, it just didn't happen. For these guys, Boye Mafe had a 6-7 game stretch where he was one of the best pass rushers in the game. Charles Cross has played games against Myles Garrett and some of the best, and he's put him in a paper bag and like, yeah, I can lock this thing down. Tariq Woolen for 9-10 weeks of a season was the defensive rookie of the year. He's undercutting balls and got 5 picks and looks like the next reincarnation of Richard Sherman. Right? I mean, you have seen some real flashes of these young guys where you're like, yes, yes, give me that. That's Cam Chancellor. That's Richard Sherman. That's Earl Thomas. That's those guys in their first couple years where I'm seeing greatness. Now, I need to see it consistently.
I was going
to
say, because for every one of those games, we've sort of seen the opposite
as
well.
Yes, you have. Yes, you have.
I mean, we saw Tariq Woolen, who wasn't even interested in tackling a guy at the end of last year.
You've seen Boye still fooled and washed down and not having discipline. You've seen, you know, Daryl Taylor, unfortunately, flash 9 sacks. And then you see him totally out of place and out of, you know, just out of his mind, you know, not playing well. So, you know, that would be, to me, some of the saving graces. Like, I don't think these are just guys. I don't think they're just average talent. I think they have shown some just flashes. What was the word that Pete would always use? Splash. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing some splash plays. Remember Frank Clark, his rookie year? You're like, oh, yes. Yes, Frankie boy. Give me that more. Give me more of that week after week. Don't disappear, like, you know, for 2 or 3 weeks at a time or 4 or 5 series at a time. I need that locked in. And this is, you know, this is where going into it, and it's not going to be Pollyanna, and there's going to be some rough spots, but Salk on paper, like going into it, this is a scheme that should unlock these guys. I'll give you a perfect example, okay? Perfect example is we're heading to the draft 10 days from now. Justin Herbert coming out of college down at Oregon. And I think if you played back the tape, as we talked about him, I'm like, I think he's good, but I'm just not seeing him take that step. I see great flashes, but I just don't see it consistently enough. And I don't know, man. Like, I'd be a little uncomfortable pulling the trigger in the top 10. And then he went to the Chargers, and guess what? They unlocked him. They unlocked him mentally. Dude is a cerebral guy. Comes from a family of academics. Comes from a family of doctors. And just, he is a very, very bright guy. And the system at Oregon was so dumbed down that it didn't maximize his horsepower. And I think at times this defensive system has been so dumbed down to just play fundamental, right? To just play rope-a-dope, to just play, don't give up the big play. Hey, let's just, versus no, man, I'm going to ignite you. I'm going to blitz you. I'm going to create chaos. I'm going to disguise you. I'm going to ask things of you that have never been asked of you before, right? And I think for some, it's going to ignite them. For others, it's going to overwhelm them, to your point. Like, I'm just excited to see. I mean, I think it's going to overwhelm Daryl Taylor. I think what's going to be asked of him, but who knows? I think it's going to be a lot for Derek Hall, but who knows? I think for Chenna and Boye, it should be right up their alley and really play. And Leonard and Jaron and you know, our new linebackers that have experience in this league, it should play to their strengths as well. So that's what's, you know, it is. It's going to be compelling theater and so different than the last 5, 6, 7, 10 years. Because A, the, you know, new pieces, but B, just schematically, I think what they're going to ask these guys to do will be a very, very different story.
Well, that's what they're asking them to do. What I'm going to ask you to do right now is answer 3 good football questions. We call it Blue 88.
This is Brock and Salk's Blue 88.
Blue 88! Blue 88!
We take you to the field as Brock Huard breaks down 3 football questions as only he can.
Now here's your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
All right, Brock, let's start here. Question number 1, pre-draft visits. Are those done now? Like, what do they have left here before the draft in the last, you know, week and a half or so?
So a couple things to keep in mind. The draft is a week from Thursday. Just kind of these technicalities and the rules and everything else. They can still bring guys in, and they're going to have a couple more still coming in until Thursday. So you can bring people to your place, have them in your building, and you can round out those 30 visits, and you have all the way until Thursday, exactly 1 week before the draft. And as I understand it, there still will be a couple guys coming in. Now, the difference is you can still go on the road until next Tuesday. So you've got a 7-day period before the draft where you can't bring him into your place. And then you got about a 48-hour period before the draft where it's done, kind of a dead period. Mm. Now it's over, the hay's in the barn. All you guys get back to your places and get ready to rock and roll. So you can still go visit them until next Tuesday, and you can have them in your building until this Thursday, and then it is over. I do think, and I don't know if you saw this note over the weekend, kind of fascinating. And tomorrow we'll have a little more discourse on Michael Penix. And over the course of this week, because I've reached out to all my draft guru buddies and trying to get a feel for where they've got him slotted. Did you see the news this weekend that both Bo Nix and Michael Penix will not be in Detroit City for the draft?
I did see that.
Yes. So the NFL did not figure, and I guess, you know, they are kind of tired of the guy sitting in the green room, camera on him the entire, you know, the entire 2-3 hours, they just trying not to put players in that kind of position, in that kind of spot. Mm-hmm. While it's good theater for all of us, I don't think they love that branding. And then certainly probably the players' agents gotten back to them and like, yeah, not worth it. Not going to do it. And I'd have been curious if Penix and Nix would have done it anyway. Even if the NFL said, no, we're not going to bring you in here. We're only going to have, I think, 14 guys this year in the green room. We're not going to have 30 of them. We're not going to have guys sitting around the next day. I'm curious if Penix and Nix, my gut would be both of those guys said, nah, I'm good. Yeah, I'm going to be with my wife if I'm Bo Nix and some of my family. And if you're Michael Penix, like, nope, I'm going to be back in Florida with my family, my friends. And, you know, there's just too much unknown. I have no idea still 10 days away exactly where I'm going to fit and where I'm going to land on that draft night.
I think there's any chance the Seahawks draft Penix.
That's a good little tease to some information that I got from a few of these
guys. All right, we'll come back to that then. Question number two. Speaking of Penix and his former home at Washington, they have spring practice underway. Mm-hmm. Who's been the talk of spring ball?
Ooh, this little QB, man. This little, like, early enrollee freshman QB. I was looking at some pictures of him. I think his name is Damon Williams. I'm like, hold on a second. Like, this guy is teeny, right?
So this isn't the transfer from Mississippi State.
No. That would be Will Rogers. No, this guy is like 5'9", 180. But Salk, I'm looking at pictures of him, and dude is a muscle ball. I mean, just one twitchy, explosive. And quite honestly, through the first, I think they're about halfway through, 6 or 7 practices. You want to talk about who has been the guy that's just turned heads? Right, who has been the guy that when Jack Del Rio and Bill Belichick and John Lynch and all these guys are coming into town and most of them wearing some Husky hoodies, who's been the guy that's been like, what in the world is that? It's been the young freshman originally committed to Arizona and Jed Fish. And then when Jed got this job, decommitted and has come here. Mm. And I'm like, well, yeah, he may be super athletic and he may be really, really talented, but can he make every... Oh, yeah. Like, he is just whipping the ball all over the field. So... And they go, Will Rogers, keep an eye out. That is not a guarantee. I know that the previous staff had given him some money and you know, really loved some of his experience. And he's been a 3-year starter in the SEC and is a productive guy. And, you know, there's kind of some Jake Browning to Will Rogers. Balls out. He anticipates and all of that. But kind of like Jake, there's not a real twitchy explosiveness to him. And with, you know, some new pieces up front, Salk, you know what typically coordinators like? Guys that can erase that with their movement and their running ability. And he is like one of the most dynamic guys on the entire field. So, yeah, talk of the town through the first half of spring ball has been the young freshman quarterback.
Very interesting. All right, question number three. I like questions like this one, Brock. How do we know the end is near?
Hey, WIAA, I'm talking to you out there. If any of you are listening, first thing on your agenda item is to get flag football for the young ladies, the young women in high school football done and accounted for in a registered, licensed sport, interscholastic sport on these high school campuses in the state. The last thing on your agenda is to put together a college-esque transfer portal.
What?
Yes.
That's happening?
Yes.
Why?
Well, you know, players need to have their own ability, Salk, to transfer. They need to be empowered to make their own moves. Who are we, like the NCAA, to tell some young person where they can go and not go? So go ahead. You know, we're not going to get in the way of you wanting to transfer. So if you just all want to go to that school and you want to go play baseball or basketball or football there, who are we? Who are we to block you and your freedom to go pursue your dreams? Collegiate level, the NCAA, certainly, and the Supreme Court went 9-0 and threw their hands up. So now we are looking at high schools, and that actually being a legitimate agenda item. A lot of conversation that the WIAA may create a very similar in the state of Washington kind of protocol to the transfer portal that we see at the collegiate level. And that is when you know the end is near.
Latest sign that the apocalypse is upon us. Yes. Huh? There you go. That is today's Blue 88. So what? You got a little Penix thought?
Oh, I reached out to, and I'm going to kind of continue to curate this because not everybody's gotten back to me. I've got about four or five guys. I just said, hey, I'm going to put you right on the spot, put a little survey together. Where is Penix going to get taken? And not team, just pick. Just give me the pick of where you think he's going to go. And there's been 44, there's been 33, there's been 13, there's been 19. And then there was one kind of big dog, one pretty big name out there that said 16.
Wow.
And I was like, let me think here. 16.
We've talked about that number quite a bit.
I think I know who's got this. Right. So then I followed up with is that a Seahawk or someone trading into 16 for the Seahawks? And then I got crickets. I mean, I got total crickets at that point. Okay. So, yeah, I don't know exactly, and I don't think that person knows exactly. Like, anybody knows exactly.
So it's not
how
like that
all
came
this...
from John Schneider. He wasn't
No. This did not come from the Seahawks. Okay. This did not just come checking. From anybody over there. No. This came from somebody, though, that will be sitting on set on that Thursday night in front of the national television audience that did think that that might just be one of those little sweet spots.
We had some fun on Friday talking about reactions, right? Just what would be your sort of emotional reaction to some of the names
when Bruce
that have
Smith,
been talked
let's
about.
Just say when Bruce Smith gets picked at 16, right? Or not Bruce Smith, Bruce Irvin back in the day.
Right.
When you looked at me like, who? We didn't talk about him at all.
Just the one guy who called our show, Adam.
Yes.
No, it was more, how will you feel? And for some of them, it was like, I guess I'll be okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to Penix. It was like, well, let's go.
You want to talk about a swing.
Right. How could you not be excited if they end up drafting Michael Penix at 16?
You'll be surprised to learn that he expressed all of his emotions about how he would feel through song.
Yeah.
Oh, did he? Oh, that's nice. That's very music. Nice. Oh,
Brock likes things
it's
like that.
It's a new thing. He just started it.
Yeah, Brock actually likes things like that. Most people like that. You're just sort of alone in your hatred for things that make life more interesting because in Maura's world, everything's got to be down the everything by the book. Just say exactly
fun.
What it is you feel and say it very clearly and distinctly.
Yeah, sort of like this.
Yep.
I enjoyed that segment. Ranked, on the other hand.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
No. Well, it had nothing to do with ranked. And here you are giving me grief in front of Brock.
Yeah.
On Brock's birthday, no less.
On Brock's birthday, no less.
You two Brock get likes when I give you grief. Happy birthday, Brock.
Thank you, Maura. But you two get along. Or maybe Salk's just trying to stir it up for 10
We're
days
rivals.
From now.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
he got someone to call in on Friday.
Oh, got someone.
Someone named Zane. That sounds made up. And say that I seem like a cheater and that I'm too mean to Salk all the time and that I'm going to cheat in the race.
Doesn't she kind of seem like a cheater?
Sheesh.
Yeah.
Wow, that is hot.
Fight
fire.
Words.
Kind of a cheater-like personality, I guess.
I mean, we're 10 days away. Have you been doing some running, Salk? Have you been stretching? And
well, I visualized, Brock. Just I didn't actually get out to the track this weekend. I just visualized what that would look
those
like.
Those reps are important, too.
Yeah, so it's just visual reps for now.
They're called mental reps.
Yeah, there's just a visualization thing before our big race coming up a week from Thursday. All right, coming up next here, I have some numbers. I don't know if you want to hear them. In fact, you might be very mad at me when I give these to you, but I've got a bunch of numbers. When you put them together, they do create one very specific pattern. It's next on Brock and Salk.